Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Now, files go missing. It's not always a conspiracy. However, I'm pretty skeptical about this.
It can be argued that governments can sometimes have good reasons to keep things from their populations. But it seems the government has been keeping vital files in Northern Ireland hidden in plain sight.
What we discovered was that a lot of these files were not being released at all, and there was a massive question around what was happening here, and the Northern Ireland Office would not answer our questions in a convincing way.
Thousands of declassified files in Northern Ireland and the Troubles have been deposited, not in Belfast, but in the Kew archives in London.
Normally, what had been happening here was that the NIO had been sending lots of their files to the Public Record Office in Belfast, and something at some point changed. Somebody took a decision in the Northern Ireland office that was going to stop. We've asked them why that happened. Clearly, it was legal for them to send them to the Public Record Office, and suddenly they decided that wouldn't happen.
Sam McBride, the Belfast Telegraph's Northern Ireland editor, has travelled to London and has been sleuthing in search of the secrets of the Troubles.
Government sometimes finds ways to hide things, and one of the ways that they try to hide things is by simply losing them or saying that they've gone missing. We should question whether all of these files are genuinely missing.
So what are the Kew files? Why are these important files quietly sequestered away in London? And of course, what secrets do they reveal?
When I looked at the names of some of these files, you get a real sense of what's involved in this and how really incredibly sensitive this is.
In episode one of a two-part special of The Bell Tell, I'm joined by Sam McBride to discuss the Kew files and what they tell us about Martin McGuinness, the IRA, and even the SDLP.
Martin McGuinness agrees to this. He doesn't push it to court. He takes the money, but they think he's going to make this public. And so they draw up these secret documents.
Sam McBride, you're very welcome to The Bell Tell.
Thank you.
Kew files. It's a mysterious name. It evokes in my head images of 1960s spy dramas. What are the Kew files?
Well, let me just go back a little bit to explain how we came to report this story. So I've been covering about 20 years worth of annual releases by government departments. So these are government files that are opened up to the public at the Public Record Office in Northern Ireland. They're declassified. We get to go in and see the stuff that previously was secret, and we report that. It happens in December every year. And for the last decade or so, it has also been happening in the summertime. So we've moved from a 30-year rule where these files are generally opened after 30 years to a 20-year rule where they're being opened after a shorter period of time, and they're phasing that in, so they're doing 2 years at a time. And one of the most significant areas of government at the Public Record Office that I always looked for was the Northern Ireland Office, the NIO. That was the big government department that was responsible for security during the Troubles, was the major government department looking at the course of the Troubles, looking at the big political developments in Northern Ireland. That's where some of the most interesting stories were. But for several years, I'd been noticing that things were changing here. Fewer and fewer NIO files were coming out at the Public Record Office in Northern Ireland. And when you get to late December 2022, the prony listings that they give to us when they open these files up, the list of files had just 5 NIO files in it. Now, normally there might be 100, 200 maybe. So this was getting almost negligible. Then 6 months after that, it was down to 3 files. And by last December, there wasn't a single entry from the Northern Ireland office. Now, last year, I did some digging into this and I tried to work out what was going on because these are hugely significant files. And what we discovered was that a lot of these files were not being released at all. And there was a massive question around what was happening here, and the Northern Ireland office would not answer our questions in a convincing way.
And you've been going up to Prony, the Northern Ireland Public Records Office, for many, many years. It's a specialism of yours. You're known for someone who gets stuck into the files, who opens them out, and to who looks for stories. That's what you're doing. You're mining these files for stories and headlines because that's our job. And you're looking for the most interesting thing. And the most sensitive files that Prony would hold normally are from the Northern Ireland office. But then you notice they're not there.
When I looked at this last year, what I discovered was that in the 5 preceding years, there were 95 NIO files that had been fully closed. So they're completely shut. We don't get a single page of those. We don't get to even look at the cover of those. It's shut to us. We do not get anything declassified there. And if you think about these files, people will not be familiar with this, but a single file could be 100 pages. It could be 400 pages. Some of these are big, thick, heavy files with an awful lot of material in them. That could be tens of thousands of pages of documentation. So we're talking about a lot of material here. And one of the legal provisions under which government can retain these files is called a security and intelligence instrument. And that relates to files where it's possible for the government to argue that they contain material relating to intelligence or national security. And that's the main reason that these files are being closed. And let's be clear, some of that material should be shut. There are people there whose lives would be at risk if some of that was put out there. Even as a journalist who believes in openness and transparency, I don't think that everything should be out there. There are certain things that as a government, they have to hold from us, and that is right and that is proper. But we should be skeptical about some of these, because when I looked at the names of some of these files, they were very, very significant and they hinted at what might be happening here. There was then a second category of material which hasn't been released, and that's 71 files in this 5-year period where they have been temporarily retained as additional time is needed to complete the administrative aspects of the transfer process before they're released. And when you look at the names of these files, you get a real sense of what's involved in this and how really incredibly sensitive this is. So there's a file called Brian Nelson Civil Claim by Mrs. Pat Finucane. There's another file called Ulster Defence Association Prescription. There's a file called Alleged Collusion Between Royal Ulster Constabulary and Loyalist Paramilitaries. These are really sensitive national security files where the NIO is not releasing these. There's then a third category of files that are not being released. And these are 21 files in this 5-year period, which are described as missing at transfer. Now, files go missing. It's not always a conspiracy. This is a massive government machine. They're moving offices. They are dealing with enormous volumes of paperwork over decades. Some of these are very old files. However, I'm pretty skeptical about this. Government sometimes finds ways to hide things. And one of the ways that they try to hide things is by simply losing them or saying that they've gone missing. So I can't prove that's what's happened here. In some cases, that will not be what's happened here. But we should question whether all of these files are genuinely missing. But then there's a final category here. And that's the biggest category, the most significant category. And these are files that haven't been released at all. They haven't been lost. They haven't been retained because they relate to national security. They simply have not been moved from the Northern Ireland office. And there are 23,477 of these files. Now think about that. 23,500 files, each of which might contain hundreds of pages. I mean, that's a building worth of material here, which ought to be released to the public. But what the NIO says is there's been a backlog. They just haven't had the time to sort through these, so they haven't been done. Now, think about the Northern Ireland office. This is a big government department where there are people doing all sorts of jobs. They've got lots of press officers, for instance. They have people doing social media videos. None of those are legal requirements. This is a legal requirement. They found the time to do things that aren't legal requirements, but they haven't found the time, they say, to do something that is a legal requirement. So there are big questions over what has happened here.
And obviously the Northern Ireland office deals with security issues, intelligence issues, what we would call spooky stuff, a lot more than, say, the Scottish office.
of course, and this is a period that covers the Troubles. This was a massive internal UK security crisis. It was something which had international dimensions to it. And so there is an incredible volume of material here that would be of interest, but this material is not being released to us.
So those are the files we haven't seen, we can't see, and we would like to see. But there are other files which you have seen and you have got stories from, and we're calling those the Q files.
So as journalists, we have very few privileges that the public don't have, frankly. We can't get these files that are hidden. But what I came to see was that there were files that were being released. They were just being released in a place where I wasn't looking and where almost nobody in Northern Ireland was looking for these files. And that's at the National Archives at Kew in Southwest London. Normally, what had been happening here was that the NIO had been sending lots of their files, as I said, to the Public Record Office in Belfast. And something at some point changed. Somebody took a decision in the Northern Ireland office that that was going to stop. We've asked them why that happened. They haven't explained it. They've denied that there's anything irregular about this. But that straightforward question, what changed and why did it change? Clearly, it was legal for them to send them to the Public Record Office. That's what they had been doing. And suddenly they decided that wouldn't happen. And so lots of these files have never been looked at. They've never been examined. They've never been reported. And they deal with some very, very sensitive and significant topics.
So what we're implying here, and I'm not sure if we can go as far as saying, it does strongly suggest that someone in government has taken the decision to send these files to Southeast London, to Kew, so that you wouldn't find them.
Look, I can't prove that. The NIO is a central government department, so it's a Whitehall department. It's part of the Westminster government. And so it has a London office and it has a Belfast office, and it still has that today. I always assumed that the files that came to the Public Record Office were the files from the Belfast office, and the files that went to the National Archives in London were from the London office. Nobody has actually confirmed that to me. I've spoken to a former NIO senior civil servant who contacted me in recent days, and his understanding was that some of the security files came to Belfast because those were the old functions of the old Stormont Parliament that had passed over to the NIO, and the other files went to London. I'm not entirely sure how that worked, but what I'm very clear about is that a lot of NIO files, more than 100 most years in the early years that I was covering this, were coming to Belfast. A lot of those were about very sensitive things, about the hunger strike, about prisons in Northern Ireland, about the RUC, about contacts with political parties at a high level, quite a secret level, lots of very significant, interesting material. And suddenly, someone decided somewhere in the Northern Ireland office that would stop. Now, they may have a reasonable explanation for that, but I'm pretty suspicious of the fact that they haven't given it to us. And to this day, there has been no explanation for why for years they were sending these files to Belfast and we were covering them, and suddenly that stopped.
So there's a huge range of material here. I went through thousands of pages of documents in these files. There are probably several hundred pages that I pulled out, that I copied. And just to explain a little bit of the process here, you go into the National Archives and they have these enormous vaults in which they store millions of documents. I mean, documents going back more than 1,000 years. And you then order those files. They're brought up to you from the vaults. You read them in a very controlled environment where there's high security to make sure that you're not going to tamper with them. And you're allowed to photograph them, copy them, take notes, etc. And what you get here is an insight into particularly the early 2000s. Those are the most recent files that we have in Kew. Northern Ireland office files, some files from Downing Street, from other government departments. And what they show is that in these years after the Good Friday Agreement, there is this enormous effort at the very top of Tony Blair's government to try to get this agreement implemented in a way that's going to stick, that's going to work. And so they're trying to get the IRA to decommission. They're trying to persuade David Trimble to give the IRA more time to decommission. They're trying to reform the RUC into the PSNI. They are dealing with loyalist paramilitarism, with loyalist feuds. They're dealing with people being killed. There's all manner of things going on here. And just to give you a sense of this, within Downing Street,
Around the year 2000, 2001, about every 2 weeks or so, there is a new file created with maybe a couple of hundred pages just on Northern Ireland. And this is not low-level stuff about Northern Ireland. This is really high-level stuff. I mean, you will have a file where Jonathan Powell refers to meeting with senior Republicans. And there's one particular document where he just refers to somewhere in West Belfast. There's another file where he says this should not be disseminated further. This should not be replayed back to Adams or McGuinness or anybody else in Sinn Féin. You get a real feel for the immediacy of what's happening here, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, and an enormous volume of material where there are conversations going on with people like Gerry Adams, people like Martin McGuinness, people like David Trimble and the people around him, and that's all being fed back into the government machine. So that's the stuff that I suppose is most up to date, but some of this goes way back much further than that, to the early 90s and right the way back to the 1970s.
Tell us about some of the headlines. I mean, one that stood out for many people was Martin McGuinness. He got a payout from the Ministry of Defence for assault and harassment at the hands of British soldiers. I think people might be surprised, first of all, the payout, because for many Republicans, this would have been, frankly, par for the course in terms of how the army would have interacted with them on a day-to-day basis. But I suppose it was perhaps surprising for some people that he went looking for the money in the first place.
Well, this is something that, to the best of my knowledge, is new. I talked to several people who might have had knowledge of this. They weren't aware of it. It was news to them. But what one of these files shows is that weeks after the IRA's first ceasefire in the middle of 1994, Martin McGuinness got a payment of £1,000 from the Ministry of Defence. And the payment centred in these allegations from Martin McGuinness that he had been harassed by British soldiers in Derry. And this dated back to 1989. He said that they had stopped him. They had asked him for his name, but he said that they used his name as they asked him his name. So in other words, they were trying it on. They were messing around with him. They knew his name, but they were trying to abuse their position. And he then said that they had punched him, that he had been physically attacked. So it was more than simply verbal. He said that there was actually a physical element to this. This went into the government machine. It takes years to go through it. Ultimately, it's shown to a barrister. And the advice that he gives, the legal advice that he gives to the Ministry of Defence is, you're in trouble here. You're probably going to lose this if it goes to court. And there were various reasons for that, one of which was that he said the law on stopping and searching people and asking for their details made clear that you had to have a legitimate reason to do that. If they already knew his name, well, you don't need to ask him his name. And that he also said that given his prominence as a senior Republican in Derry, it was hard to believe that soldiers who had been briefed on the senior Republicans in that area wouldn't have known who he was. So you've got this problem for the MOD and they decide, look, we just need to cut our losses here. We need to settle. It's politically a bit awkward. This is a senior IRA figure, senior Sinn Féin figure at the same time. It's not going to look great for them that they're paying him money, but it's what they've got to do. It's worse if it goes to court and they lose there. And Martin McGuinness agrees to this. He doesn't push it to court. He takes the money. He accepts no liability from the MOD. They don't admit that they did anything wrong, but they do pay out. But they think he's going to make this public. And they have lines to take that are quite defensive. What if he says that he's got this money? How do we explain that we've given money to a leading terrorist, as they describe him? And so they draw up these secret documents to deal with the anticipated queries. And so far as I can see, the queries never come. So they thought this would be a great PR coup for him. And for some reason, he never publicised it. Now, I talked to Ed Maloney, who's the author of A Secret History of the IRA, knows the wider Republican movement in a very deep way over many, many decades. And he didn't know about this. And he said he was interested by this because he thought that to older generations of Republicans, they would not have taken the money. They would have viewed it as a badge of honour, if you like. But this is new information, as far as I can see, that we didn't know until we saw these files.
Another headline which stood out for me was that the IRA was running out of money in 1994 to run that organisation, and they had no strategy to replenish those funds.
One of the interesting elements about this, and this also is from 1994, but this is a document where we don't see very many of this type of document. It's a document from the Joint Intelligence Committee, but this is the big government committee that pulls together the various strands of intelligence for the British government, for the British government in its widest possible interpretation. And there is a document here from 1994. It's 2 months after the IRA ceasefire, and this document document says there's no coherent strategy from the IRA to make up its funding shortfall, and it links this to what they expect is going to be a big political push by Sinn Féin in the US to be given permission to raise money there. Now, we know that during the Troubles, Norrie had raised a lot of money that ended up in the hands of the IRA. We know that then Friends of Sinn Féin ultimately became the organisation that to this day raises lots of money for Sinn Féin. But there is a period here where the idea of Gerry Adams going to America is incredibly controversial to the British government. They fight it tooth and nail. But even after he goes, they are trying to say, well, at least do not let him raise money. And here you see one of the reasons for that. They've been told, and we now know obviously that the IRA were incredibly well infiltrated, so I think it's fair to assume that this was pretty good intelligence, that there was a money problem here. This is marked with a very high security classification of confidential, covering secret, UK eyes alpha. So that means that nobody who is outside the UK civil service, who has clearance to read secret documents and who is a British citizen, can read this document. So if you're an Irish citizen, if you're an American citizen, you're not allowed to read this. This really is being treated in a very restricted way within the government machine. And it is, I suppose, something that helps us understand that at this point, the IRA, yes, was thinking strategically about peace. It was thinking about politics. It was thinking about what its volunteers were thinking about where it was moving. But that wasn't the only thought. It had money worries. And ultimately, we see later in some of these other documents where there is a robbery on a post office in Newry. There is a civilian who is killed in this period. And there is a message that is given to John Dew, who is the deputy head of mission at the British Embassy in Dublin. It's given to him by Nell McCafferty, the journalist. And she tells him as well, just a month after this Joint Intelligence Committee assessment, she tells him the IRA are desperately short of money. So seems to be a very different source for this information, but the same message is coming from that source. And she says that the Newry post office robbery, quote, had been traumatic for the Sinn Féin leadership, and in particular, as she had herself seen, for Martin McGuinness personally. It was not possible to hand back the money, she had been told, without acknowledging that it was a crime rather than a military act, and thus leaving no logical argument against handing over the escaped perpetrators.
The SDLP also get a mention. Obviously, in that period that we're speaking about, the SDLP was once the dominant party of nationalism. The government looked at leaving the SDLP to die naturally. What do we mean by that?
Some people look at this and say, does this show that the government simply decide which political parties exist in Northern Ireland? I think that's reading too much into this. This is the government trying to work out, do we stick with the Ulster Unionist Party and the SDLP and do whatever we can to help them, to prop them up, to shape government policy in ways that help David Trimble and John Hume? Or do we basically cut our losses and say, at least on the SDLP side, that Sinn Féin are just going to be the dominant party of nationalism, as they ultimately became, as we now know, and therefore forget about the SDLP. It's a waste of our time trying to persuade them to come on board, make concessions that Sinn Féin want, and that's more durable. That's ultimately going to get us to a better position. This document is interesting, not just for what it says, but because of who wrote this document. It's written by a man called Francis Campbell. He's from County Down. He went on to become the first British ambassador to the Holy See, to the Vatican, who is a Catholic. He's from Northern Ireland. He's a quite devout Catholic. And since the Reformation, there had never been a Catholic diplomat who had been sent to that post. Tony Blair appointed him to that post. And he was appointed after having served several years as Tony Blair's private secretary. So that's a very significant role within government, private secretary to the Prime Minister. This was actually just before he came into that role. So he's in the Downing Street machine. He's not quite at that level yet, but that's where he would go on to get to. So a very significant figure. And what he looks at here is the arguments for and against, and he weighs it up. And ultimately what he says is that if the SDLP falls apart, if it goes, if it vanishes, and if the Troubles return, if there's a return to violence, it's going to be much worse than the Troubles. A Troubles without the SDLP, he decides, is a deadlier thing. It's something which the government has less control over. It's a situation in which there's less moderation. And he thinks that it won't just be about trying to get rights, as he suggests the early days of the Troubles had been, but it will be about secession. It's about really getting rid of the British link. And he thinks with a significant bulk of the Irish nationalist population in Northern Ireland behind Sinn Féin, that's a really dangerous thing. So he looks at this in the round and ultimately he comes down on the side. And we know that the government did stick with the SDLP for a while after this. But ultimately there's that infamous, I think it's fair to say, line, which I think Seamus Mallon said, Tony Blair once said in a sort of jovial way to the SDLP, that the problem with you guys is that you don't have guns. So ultimately the SDLP had the difficulty that Sinn Féin could give the government something in decommissioning that the SDLP just could not reciprocate.
Coming up in part two of the Q Files, we'll be looking at what they said about ex-DUP leader Peter Robinson.
So there was an allegation made at the time by Peter Robinson that the UK government had hired a mercenary, a former SAS person, to murder him in the Irish Republic.
About Ulster resistance.
This was something which Ian Paisley was central to setting up, and in it Ian Paisley is heard to say that he will give whatever political cover is needed to this new organisation. Now, ultimately, in late 1987, Ulster resistance joined together with the UDA and the UVF. They imported a massive shipment of arms.
And about the terrorism charges against Noah Little, father of the Deputy First Minister, Emma Little Pengelly.
In 1989, he was arrested by French police in Paris with an American arms dealer. They were trying to sell missile technology from Shorts to the South African apartheid regime.
This episode of The Bell Tale was produced by Olivia Peden. The sound design was by Graham Davidson.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.